From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Contemporary China built a huge pot of wealth selling nearly everything to the USA. 200 years ago, it was young America building fortunes and confidence in trade with China, the Celestial Empire. Teas and furs, porcelain and near slaves, opium. That history still moves behind today's big power drama. This hour On Point, when America first met China. You can join the conversation. How long does history's impact last? How long does it shape nations and their perspectives and their ties? Would you have sailed for all the tea in China? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is award-winning author and historian Eric J. Dolan. He wrote Leviathan, The History of Whaling in America, and Fur, Fortune, and Empire, The Epic History of the Fur Trade in America. The next step, his new book, out today. It is When America First Met China, an exotic history of tea, drugs, and money in the age of sail. Eric, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We know the point we're at today. It's a really interesting point in the relationship between these two great nations. But take us back. You remind us. Here we are just after the American Revolution. The U.S. had been under the heel, the rule of England. And you say suddenly we had the representatives of the newest country in the world. That was us. Coming face to face with those of one of the oldest. Paint the picture of that America and that China at that time when this meeting first was about to take place.
Okay. Well, keep in mind that before the American Revolution, Americans had long had a love affair with things Chinese because the British East India Company had brought Chinese tea, silk, and porcelain to the colonies for well over 100 years. But the Americans had been shut out of that trade.
That was
entirely.
A monopoly, and it wasn't open to Americans.
Yeah, but they had eagerly looked at those opportunities for many years and even vaguely threatened that they too would go to China despite the disapproval of their British brethren. But then after the American Revolution, we had won. And the monopoly of the British East India Company had evaporated. So Americans were looking for a way to build their own economic might, and China was a perfect opportunity.
So paint those two pictures, that young America and its needs and ambitions vis-a-vis the world in China. And on the other side of the Pacific, that China, and we're talking, what, 1780s, early right. 1780s here.
Well, here you had an America that the colonists had been annually consuming more than a billion cups of tea. So they wanted to fill a void for Chinese goods. They were in disarray, the country. There was a lot of bickering between the states. Mm-hmm. People didn't know how they were going to make their way in the world. But merchants who had made a lot of money during the war, in many cases as privateers, had capital.
Snatching up British ships and taking their goods.
Mm-hmm. They had capital to invest. Mm-hmm. And China was this sterling opportunity. But on the other side of the world, 18,000 miles away, sat China, the imperial Middle Kingdom, which had been trading with the West for hundreds of years. Many, many nations had been knocking on their door. Mm-hmm. They knew virtually nothing about this new United States, but they were more than happy to have Westerners and other countries come to Canton, now modern-day Guangzhou, mm-hmm. to trade their goods and their silver for Chinese goods.
On their terms, at least their terms still in 1782-83.
Oh, absolutely.
That would change in a way not very advantageous to China during the period you cover, which is between the aftermath of the American Revolution and the Civil War.
Right.
18,000 sailing miles from the United States, which is not as the seagull flies, if it could. I was fascinated. I mean, there are so many stories in this. They've been made into such romantic tales in our fiction and in movies. You remind us that there is a lot in here that is romantic and a lot that is not romantic, a lot that was very tough, and we will talk about that. But just to give us a sense of the different texture of life at that time, I wish you'd tell us the story of John Ledyard. This was a kid who grew up in Groton, Connecticut, and I went to Dartmouth at one point. Mm-hmm. I think dropped out was kicked out, okay. I mean, at one point, I think he built a dugout canoe, you remind us,
yes.
and was the first, maybe white guy, plenty of Native Americans, but white guy to paddle from Hanover, New Hampshire, where my colleague Jack Beatty sits, all the way down the Connecticut River to Hartford, Connecticut.
Yes, where his family was.
And then what was it that put him in the middle of all this, that took him around the world? How did that unfold?
Well, he was an itinerant soul from the very beginning. And in about 1775, he headed over to England. And
he had been out already, had he, sailing?
He'd been transporting mules and molasses and flour
and sugar between Africa and Europe, the West Indies.
Right. So he was familiar with maritime enterprise.
Okay.
But he ended up in London. And whether he signed on or was impressed, it's not clear, which is sort of forced into service. But he found himself on one of Captain James Cook's ships heading out in another fruitless effort to find the Northwest Passage to the Orient.
James Cook, the great explorer of the Pacific Ocean.
Yes. And then they went around Cape Horn, and they went up to the Pacific Northwest. And by that time, all the men in the ships had been on board for a couple of years, and their clothes were in tatters.
This is 1778 or something.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they started trading with the local Indians who had sea otter pelts.
Well, this was off of Vancouver,
Vancouver Island. Southwest mm-hmm. corner of Vancouver Island. Mm-hmm. And in short order, they'd accumulated about 1,500 pelts. Now, they had accumulated them primarily for utilitarian purposes. They needed something to wear, but when they got to Canton, minus Captain Cook, I might add, who was slain on the Hawaiian Islands, mm-hmm. they discovered that they had a veritable fortune on their hands, because these sea otter pelts could command upwards of $100 from Chinese mandarins who had been exposed to sea otter pelts for many years from Japan and from the Russians. But now there was this new source. So an almost mutiny ensued. These men wanted to go right back.
$100 for each pelt. This was huge.
Huge. This is a time at which laborers in the colonies might expect to earn $1 a day. So they wanted immediately, the men wanted immediately mm-hmm. to go back to the Pacific Northwest. But cooler heads prevailed, and they headed back to London. And Ledyard was one of these men on board. And when he got back to London, he finally made his way back to the, not quite the United States yet, in 1782.
Right.
And he wrote a book about his adventures with Captain Cook. It was the first book copyrighted in the United States.
Wow.
And in that book, he talked about the riches that could be had if you were to go to the Pacific Northwest and bring these sea otter pelts to China.
I mean, he was salivating. He wrote
the
skins, which did not cost the purchaser 6 pence sterling, sold in China for $100. This was the sort of internet-sized boom fortune of his day waiting to be made, as he
like
saw it.
The fur trade El Dorado.
Yeah.
He saw dollar signs, and he immediately set out to try to entice people who had deeper pockets to fund a venture with him at the lead of that venture to go to China.
And he had some success, though it went up and down. At one point, he almost had an armada ready to sail out. And then finally, it's just one ship, very famously, the Empress of China. When did it sail? The first American ship to China.
Well, it's important to note that Ledyard was sort of left behind. He enticed Robert Morris, and Robert Morris, the financier of the revolution, was going to send a whole armada, but then he narrowed it down and he finally sort of edged Ledyard aside. But mm-hmm. the Empress of China, this beautiful ship, and there's only one image of it left on a fan that was made in China in 1784, mm-hmm. but it departed New York City on February 22nd, 1784. And it headed down the East River. And what was really fascinating to me is
this was such a short time after the British had been booted, right?
Yes. Oh,
you describe how just months before the
evacuation day.
The evacuation day where they had nailed the Union Jack to a flagpole in their fort, greased the pole so Americans couldn't take it down, and finally left. It's just months later when this was such a young country, the disarray you describe, and needing a certain affirmation that they could go out on their own in a way and trade with the world.
Absolutely. They had the confidence, and they wanted to prove to the world that they were an international force, trading force, commercial force that needed to be reckoned with. But on that day, February 22nd, it was just a fascinating day for mm-hmm. a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. Because at the very same time that the Empress of China was heading down the East River, the Edward was heading down the East River for London. And on it were the definitive articles of peace. So here you have this Edward announcing to the world, this is our birth certificate.
Mm-hmm.
We're a new nation.
We've won our independence, and here are the text.
Yes,
here's
and
the
then
document.
At the same time, you mm-hmm. have the Empress of China, which is making an announcement of its own, that we're here to compete on the international field of commerce. And that wasn't the only coincidence. Sort of the interesting thing on that day, February 22nd, as we know, is George Washington's birthday. This was George Washington's 52nd birthday.
The war, 52nd only, and all that accomplished, the war and its alliances continued to shape history here. When this American ship, the first one to go to Canton, gets down by Sumatra, gets into sort of pirate territory, and it runs into a couple of French ships. This had been the great American ally, and they agree, over tea and crumpets or whatever they had there, to escort them through the sort of maybe most dangerous part of this journey to Canton itself.
Right, to the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. It was a fortuitous meeting for the men on board the Empress of China because the most dangerous part of a trip to China were the last 700-800 miles because the waters off of southwestern China were infested, or southeastern China mm-hmm. were infested with maybe upwards of 70,000 pirates at the time. So these three French ships and the captain of one of them had been to China many times before, patted the Americans on the back. They drank brandy and they toasted the recent victory over the English
Lion. Vive la Revolution!
Yes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the beginnings of the U.S.-China relationship. Trade, clipper ships, tea, opium, fortunes. 200 and more years ago, Eric J. Dolan writes about it in his new book, When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. He's with me in the studio. What was the environment that Americans found there in today Guangzhou, then Canton?
Oh, it was a walled-off city where the Chinese contained all the foreign merchants who wanted to get those Chinese goods. It was an area
on an island in the Pearl River off Canton.
Right. Well, first they would go to Whampoa, which is a small island. The ships would dock there. Then they'd go 10 miles further up the Pearl River to Canton. In this little area of 12 acres sat all the buildings or factories, because the men who worked there were called factors, mm-hmm. of all the foreign countries.
And almost all. China had its own bases for relations long with Japan and Russia. But Europeans, this is where they came.
Yeah. And they were kept there. It wasn't totally pleasant, but it wasn't thoroughly unpleasant either. They were operated under the so-called eight regulations of this Canton trading system. They could only leave this 12-acre compound a couple of times a month. They couldn't cavort or carouse. They had to be chaperoned, and they could only go a few places. No women were allowed in.
They couldn't be taught Chinese by China, the language, on pain of death to the Chinese who would teach them.
Absolutely. It was a cloistered existence. The Chinese wanted to keep foreign influences out of the rest of the country, and they also wanted to contain the trading operations, because traders and merchants were not looked up to in China. They were sort of looked down upon.
What were the main items of trade in Canton?
Well, the main items that came on the American side, silver was the number one thing that was brought in to purchase the goods. There was ginseng, sea otter furs, seal skins, beche de mer, which is sea cucumber, which mm-hmm. is used to flavor soups.
Who brought them in? I mean, Americans brought that to China?
Oh, absolutely. Huh. The Americans would stop off in Fiji and Hawaii, and they'd work
with them off the ocean floor.
Oh, they wouldn't do the scraping. They would basically trade with the mm-hmm. local the natives mm-hmm. who would then do all the work to get the beche de mer. And another item was sandalwood, which had a fragrant oil within mm-hmm. that was much prized in China. On the Chinese side, what they gave to the Americans and other Westerners, the predominant item was tea. I mean, the British were drinking enormous quantities of tea, as were the Americans. And then there was silk, porcelain, lacquerware, all sorts of things.
Was newly independent America still buying tea from the British, or it all became now carried in on American ships?
No, there is still a common. I mean, right after the American Revolution, the trade still continued mm-hmm. between America and England. Mm-hmm. But now, as an increasing number of American ships were going directly to China, a lot of the tea, and certainly the majority of the tea that was being consumed in the United States, was being brought back in American bottoms or American ships. And in fact, during the French Wars and the wars that sort of roiled Europe mm-hmm. for the late 1700s and early 1800s, the Americans actually ended up re-exporting a lot of the tea that they had imported over to Europe, because they were neutral carriers of choice during these wars between France and Britain and other countries.
Fortunes were made here.
Fortunes. Oh, absolutely. Some of the people you might have heard of, John Jacob Astor, of course, who made a fortune in fur trading. Mm-hmm. He had a fleet of ships that went to Canton. There was Stephen Girard of Philadelphia and Elias Haskett Derby of Salem, Massachusetts, called King Derby. It made them among the richest men in the United States. Derby was the first millionaire, Astor the first multimillionaire. And Girard nearly equaled Astor's fortune.
And there were many more. Those fortunes eventually rolled into what development of this continent?
Oh, they took the men who made, and it was predominantly men at the time, who made these vast fortunes. They didn't let their capital lay still. They invested in a lot of upcoming opportunities in the newly industrializing and expanding America. There was insurance companies. Of course, railroads were huge sinks for investment at the time. And Western migration and all any kind of industrial activity that you could possibly think of probably had some Chinese money flowing through it.
So the capital accumulated in this great age of sail and the clipper ships was really built the fundament in many ways of the American economy that would follow, or very important to that.
It certainly contributed a lot to that.
Now, talk to us about two elements that weren't tea and porcelain and ginseng and furs. Furs, I mean, that had its own price. You've written about it before, but I mean, huge populations wiped out.
Right.
There was also opium.
Yes.
And there was also the trade in human labor. Opium first. Describe the shape of that trade and the American role in it.
Okay. Opium solved a problem for Westerners, primarily the British. The Chinese were not that interested in a lot of Western manufacturers, so they demanded silver to pay for the Chinese goods. But to gather all that silver, especially like Spanish dollars, and was very difficult and strained the treasuries of the countries and the companies that were involved. So the British sort of hit upon this idea first in the late 1700s that there was an increasing interest in opium coming from India in China. And the thing is, opium was illegal in China, so it had to be smuggled in, and the smugglers would pay for it in silver. So all of a sudden, as you ramped up opium imports, more and more silver was leaving China, and the British could use that silver to in turn purchase all the tea and other goods that their citizens desired. Now, America followed in the footsteps of the British in the early 1800s. First, they imported opium from Turkey, which was a lesser quality than Indian opium, and then later on, they got in on the Indian opium trade as well. The British were far and away the leaders in the opium trade. By the late 1830s, there may have been as many as 40,000 chests of opium entering Canton.
And it went even higher after British military intervention. The Chinese said no and said no again and said no again. And finally, there was the Opium War.
Yeah, there was, well, the first Opium War in the late 1830s, and then there was another one in the late 1850s.
And remind us of the dynamic. What happened in those?
Well, the Chinese emperor had been growing increasingly concerned about this flood of opium entering their country, not only because of increasing rates of addiction, but also because a lot of the wealth in, in silver was leaving the country.
Our minds can't help but go to what comes across the Mexican border in the Caribbean right now. But anyway,
there are a lot of parallels with the modern drug trade. And so they clamped down. They said they sent Commissioner Lin to Canton. He confiscated 20,000 chests of opium from the British primarily and imprisoned, quote-unquote, the foreigners in the Canton factory area for some time until they turned over the opium. And this precipitated a reaction on the part of the British in which they didn't like how they were being treated. They had long disliked this sort of vassalage relationship between China and the rest of the world and their traders. And they initiated what became known as the Opium War, and they quickly bested the Chinese. And as a result, the treaty that was signed not only broke open trade to four other ports besides Canton, but the Chinese were forced to pay for the cost of the war and also to pay for the cost of all the destroyed opium, $21 million. They ceded Hong Kong, and there were other concessions, and it was a humiliating defeat.
And this wasn't a diplomatic minuet. I mean, remind us, this was British warships sailing right up Chinese rivers into China, practically not raising cities, but Chinese committing suicide as British soldiers took over their city.
Yes, it was you know, China at the time had almost 400 million people,
mm-hmm.
but their military had long been looked down upon by Westerners, and they were, in fact,
rightly
far
behind.
Rightly, it turned out, because the British force only had initially 4 to maybe 8,000 men, but they had quite a number of ships, including steamships.
So this really was at the point of bayonet and cannon and British ship that China ceded sovereignty, really, over all these trading posts and its own fate, in a way.
Yes, it was... considered the unequal treaties, and it was...
Did Americans protest this or profit from it?
Oh, they profited from it. The Americans didn't take part in the First or the Second Opium War other than tangentially,
mm-hmm.
but the Americans certainly benefited because after the British got their own treaty, the Americans got theirs that enabled them to have the same benefits to trade that the British had achieved, and they thought that this was going to be an open opportunity to expand trade with China.
What about the coolie trade? What's a coolie? C-O-O-L-I-E.
Well, Cooley, this is one of the most horrific things that I learned in writing this book, that during the mid-1800s, nearly a quarter of a million Chinese, mainly men, were taken to Latin America to serve as, in effect, slaves on sugar, cotton, and tobacco plantations.
This was when the world was turning against the trade in African slaves at long last.
Mm-hmm.
These were not technically slaves, but as you described their lives, they might as well have been. What percentage of them survived these 10-year, quote-unquote, contracts?
Oh, in some places, Cuba was as low as 50%, and Peru, 75% died before their contracts ended. And on the Chincha Islands, where the most
off Peru,
the most horrific aspect of the coolie trade, where they had to dig guano or bird waste to be used as fertilizer by Europeans and Americans.
Ammonia stinking under the whip.
Absolutely.
Huge daily quotas, you write.
Committing suicide, jumping off the sides of these
mountains. Because it was so horrific.
So horrific. And the death rate there probably approached 90%, if not more. Precious few coolies ever saw their homeland again.
Why was this scale of humanity available? You know, I don't know if they were tricked into it. Did they sign up for it? Why were there so many Chinese desperate to get out and go to this kind of hope? Did they even know what they were signing up for?
Well, both. Many were tricked into getting aboard these coolie ships that would take them to Latin America. Others were just desperate. The people who tricked them into getting on often used gambling as a lure, would stake them a claim, and they'd gamble on these ships, and then they'd lose all their money.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, well, if you want to pay off your debt, you have to get on this ship and go to Latin America. So a lot of them were desperate. Keep in mind that this was a very desperate time for China, and there were many, many poor people coming from the inner parts of China to the coast.
China was increasingly unraveling internally here, a 2,000-year empire kind of coming apart at the seams.
Absolutely.
Eric J. Dolan is with us. His new book is When America First Met China. We're going to talk about the impact of all this history still on relations today. We've got a lot of people who want to speak with you, Erica. Jacinto's calling from New York City. Jacinto, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've done work in the coolie trade mostly with Cuba and some with Peru. The ships that were going, they were tricked into boarding to the Americas, was an English ship. It was an English-Cuban run company that did most of the trade with this coolies. And one of the things that I wanted to point out was that this interesting event, which was the Chinese Commission, a report on the trade, which was a rather singular event for their diplomacy, since they seldom took part on any kind of international treaties like this.
Yeah.
Or international. And the other thing is like there is a Cuban author, Nicolas Tanco, actually he's Colombian, who recalls his adventures in China as a representative of a coolie company. And he tells the story how he was in the ship with a Russian representative who was taking the treaty after the Opium War back to Moscow, and how he befriends this Russian diplomat,
Jacinto, and, let us pick it up right there, if we may. Jacinto, with the research into the coolie trade into Cuba,
right,
saying mainly English ships. Where did the United States come into the coolie trade, and how? And thanks, Jacinto, for your call. But Eric, where's the U.S. come in here exactly?
Well, the United States was a major transporter of coolies, and that's to say that there weren't many other nations. 19 different nations participated in it, but the Americans sent roughly 62 ships that carried probably tens of thousands mm-hmm. of coolies between 1852 and 1862. And that diplomatic mission and report that the caller refers to is discussed in the book, and it's one of the things that led to the official end of the coolie trade.
1862 under Abraham Lincoln.
Right, and then later, much later for some of the other countries.
But I mean American, by law.
Yes,
in 1862. Tim in Cumberland, Kentucky. Tim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a film fairly recently, 21 Days in Peking, and it seemed it was toward the end of the Chinese, I don't know what you would call it, empire, and they were talking about the Boxer Rebellion.
Charlton Heston, 55 days in Peking, I think it was.
55, thank you.
Yeah, old film, yeah.
And it seemed like religion was playing a strong factor in there, that they were kind of very insular against religion. I wonder if that's going to kind of become a really big factor now with the new world governments and stuff, because, I mean, we've gotten more secular in our thinking. But still, religion is a very hot, tough topic all around the world.
Well, you raised the issue of culture right there, and religion is part of it. It wasn't all trade in objects. There were also American missionaries who were making, and others, who were making inroads in China.
Right. Even though the book ends well before the Boxer Rebellion, during the early 1800s, there were missionaries from not only America but England and other places trying to spread Christianity through China with very limited success early on. And oftentimes they were acting in concert with the opium traders. While they were on one hand railing against the opium trade, many of the missionaries in America, when the Opium War finally came, thought that this might finally crack open the closed empire of China and aid in their opportunities to proselytize.
What a combination. I mean, opium and religion. I mean, I wonder how you look at all this as you write it. There is inescapably a romance to this. I mean, look at those clipper ships. They're so beautiful. And you had cultures meeting. And that is and was exciting. On the other hand, here's one of our listeners says, exotic history, looking at your title here, says, surely you mean to say barbaric history. No need to rewrite history as romance novel.
The book definitely does not paint this history in romantic terms, but just like the whaling industry and the fur industry that I wrote about before, there are romantic elements to it in the sense of how it was perceived at the time and still mm-hmm. how it's perceived today. I think the presentation of the history of the China trade is very balanced in the book and certainly doesn't skimp on the horrors that relate to the opium trade, the coolie trade, the tragedy of the commons that destroyed sea otter populations, sandalwood groves.
The Chinese see themselves decade by decade as abused by this trade? Was that the common perception in China? Or not making money?
Early on, it was making money. When the opium trade really ramped up, it was more on the side of being abused by that aspect of it.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the beginnings of the U.S.-China relationship. Trade, clipper ships, tea, opium, coolies, fortunes, 200 and more years ago. My guest today is Eric J. Dolan. His new book, out today, is When America First Met China, An Exotic History of Tea, Drugs, and Money in the Age of Sail. It was a different time. Here, a listener writes to us, Marco Polo. Motivations, right? Gems, spices, textiles, and Jean-Baptiste Tavernier used to journey east. They'd be gone for 10 years at a time. Our listener writes, I use jets. I can be in and out of these places in a week, and I don't need bodyguards or grenadiers for that matter. Joey says, Americans and others traded animal furs and silver for the Chinese tea and silk and so on. Joey asks, what did the Chinese use the silver for? Why did they have such a great demand for silver, Eric?
A large part of their economy ran on silver. They paid their government officials and their military in silver, and also the people paid their taxes in silver, even though their everyday expenditures were in copper.
Wow. The trade, it got exotic during this, 70, 80 years that you write about. It started out pretty, there's silk and tea and porcelain. But it was two-way trade then as it is now. And you've got a little reading about how, I was reading, about the knockoff trade that came so early, up to and including maybe even painted portraits of our national leaders. The famous Gilbert portrait of George Washington got repainted again and again in China. You've got a reading that explains how some of this came to be, what kind of objects were very early on getting turned around on demand from the U.S. Could you share that?
Sure. There was, however, also an entirely new type of import from China, the Chinese knockoff. By the early 1830s, the Carnes' brothers of New York City, Francis and Nathaniel, had grown rich importing goods from France, such as perfumes, porcelain, fans, and silk. That's when they came up with a novel idea. Why not have Chinese craftsmen replicate French goods for a fraction of the cost? After all, since the Chinese had shown great facility copying Western paintings and artistic styles, why couldn't they do the same for other items? And how about making cheaper versions of popular European foods and drugs as well? So the Carnes sent European samples to Canton, and the results were spectacular. In this way, a new era was born. Americans, especially the slowly emerging middle class, who had discretionary income and a hankering for the exotic, were ready to buy. Faux French silk scarves and feather fans, along with delicious sauces, sweetmeats, syrups, rose oil, and other impressive imitations flooded into French-crazed New York, where they sold for authentic prices. This was excellent news for the Carneses, since the knockoffs were ridiculously cheap compared to the real things. The Chinese even managed to find a pulpy wood that, when pickled and packaged just right, could pass for the much more expensive rhubarb. Although a few children reportedly died from eating too much of this product, it sold quite well.
Boy, that's a very early and amazingly specific and nuanced knockoff trade, even of rhubarb, but be careful about that one, I think. Eric J. Dolan reading there from his new book, When America First Met China. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina, just back from Charlotte. Joel, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom. How are you doing?
Very well. What's your question?
I received a degree in history, and I grew up not far from a very large Chinatown in and just outside of Boston. Mm-hmm. And I'm drawing parallels between our immigration situation now in the States and what was going on during the Cooley period and Manifest Destiny. Well, on the West Coast, all of the railroad builders, all the launderers, they were all Chinese. But they seemed to develop their own little communities that became these Chinatowns, whereas today it seems like the people are sending their money back home to better off the people there. I'm wondering, were the Chinese that came here in the mid-1800s, were they trying to set up shop here and that's why it happened? Or was their intent to send money back to China to better their own families and it just didn't work?
Interesting question, Joel. Eric?
Yeah. But I have to answer with a caveat. Although my book does talk about the immigration of Chinese to the United States, I make a strong distinction between that immigration, which was often on the credit ticket system where they would actually come over and pay off their debts, distinguishing that from the Cooley trade, which was truly part of the China trade, in this case, in human bodies. But to answer part of your question, yes, even back then they would send back some of their earnings to home, and many of them, in fact, went back home eventually, but they also, many stayed here despite the persecution that was rampant, especially in the late 1850s and 60s.
One more right here, Janet in Boston. Hi, Janet. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Enjoying the show. I was concerned about the use. I know that you have to use the word coolie in the text, and that is what was used at the time. But given the political times that we're in and hostility towards the Chinese because of the economy, I sometimes get concerned when people use a term and think that it's being used correctly. It's like the term tar baby. Even Mitt Romney got busted for using that. And people would say, well, I use that, but only behind closed doors. But it's what's said behind closed doors that closes other doors.
Well, you're making the point that there was a kind of disparaging quality to this. It sounds like you're equating it with disparaging language that were used for African Americans in this country. And I have no doubt that, it has been used in that way. Eric J. Dolan, at the same time, it was a category of labor. Now, not a respected category, an abused category. I don't know. Do you have any second thoughts about using it as a historical term?
No, I understand the questioner's concern, but keep in mind what I'm trying to do is tell the history of the era, and that was the term that was used, and in many cases it was disparaging then. But I am using it only in the book and now as I speak as a reference to something that was taking place in the mid-1800s, not at all a reference to anything that is taking place today or any individuals that are alive today.
But it was a tough reality then. Eric J. Dolan's new book is When America First Met China. He's with me in the studio. Eric, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation, if I may, for a minute, from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Michael H. Hunt, Emerson Professor of History Emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, specialist on U.S.-China relations. His new book is Arc of Empire, America's Wars in Asia, from the Philippines to Vietnam. Professor Hunt, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Here we are looking back on what can seem like exotic or romantic or very abusive history sometimes from 200 and some years ago. Now we have China in a very new chapter and challenging the United States in many ways for global power, or at least these two great powers looking warily at one another, trying to figure out how they're going to share this global stage. Is this history most palpable and important to China today as it looks at the United States or to the U.S. as it looks at China? Is it still alive in our relationship today, Professor Hunt?
Well, yeah, the answer is clearly yes. So you commented earlier about getting beyond the pain and illusion of history, and historians like to think we never get beyond our history. We may struggle to get beyond the problems of the history, but not the history itself. I mean, I was struck in listening to Eric, you two of you talk about the book, by how much there are themes that persist. And one of them struck me very forcefully is the degree to which government is involved or trade is regulated. I mean, we complain today about the way China conducts its trade and protectionism, managed currency, got state involvement in the economy. Mm-hmm. And here we go back, to the late 18th, early 19th century, and we have the same thing in spades, very striking.
What about
partly the free market model that we would like to see China, fully adopt? They've moved toward, but we'd like to see them fully adopt.
What about China's sense of victimization? I mean,
right,
it had been a great empire. It had seen itself, as Eric reminds us, as not just an important country, but as the middle kingdom, sort of between heaven and earth.
Yeah. No, I think that's the other major thing that strikes me here is that the period Eric's describing is the great decline of, here there is a kind of historical disjuncture. I mean, we've got China going downhill, the British beating down the door, in the early part of the 19th century, the Americans following behind. And some people have called it since jackal diplomacy. I mean, the British did the dirty work, and we moved in and took advantage of all the concessions the British extracted. But the phase, as you were suggesting, the phase we're in now in the 20th century and into the 21st is one of China's gradual recovery, sort of reaching the low point early in the 20th century and increasingly assertive. I think in a way probably most Americans think of China coming back, say with Deng Xiaoping and the economic reforms of the 1980s and on. It actually begins probably, we could come back to this with the Communist Revolution and the kind of assertiveness of Mao Zedong's period of control. So there is that kind of shift, but the thing that's fascinating for me, and I think you alluded to this, is the myth of humiliation. I mean, this period of decline, serves in the Chinese imagination in two ways. I mean, it provides a benchmark for what China wants to get back to. I mean, it wants to get back to the period, of Chinese greatness, sort of the high point of the Qing Empire in the 17th century. A country of vast proportions, great power, great standing in the world. I mean, in fact, it's true. If you look at the economic data, China is really enormously accounted for a large part of the global production. But the other thing, of course, that Chinese, with a sense of pride, cultural and national pride, you know, is a sense of humiliation. This is what the Westerners did to us and the Japanese. We need to get, you know, we need to push them back, to end that humiliation. So there's kind of hypersensitivity in Chinese nationalism.
To be very wary, even as they rise. Exactly. Michael Hunt, we've got a comment here online from Zheng Liu, who writes to us, "The empire of ancient China was on the brink of collapse when America, a young, vibrant power, came into contact with it." Zheng Liu writes, "Speaking, talking about the divine mandate, the first encounter of the two nations is no less than the agent for an extreme makeover, dynasty replacement," and says that the Chinese history books repeatedly emphasize this. And this listener writes, despite the political rhetoric, you know, the nationalism on China's part, this historical period or event is credited for the rebirth of the modern China, and should rightfully be so. That, you know, this contact with the Western world was a challenge to a dynasty that was in trouble. Do the Chinese, in your perspective, Michael Hunt, also somehow give it credit for, you know, popping old illusions, helping clear the decks so that China would come back more renewed?
Right. Well, yeah, I think that's, yeah, I mean, that's a fair way to put it, I think. I mean, the question that, the way it was often put, you know, increasingly through the 19th century was, you know, how did the West gain this power? What's the matter with us? Why can't we stand up to them?
Yeah.
And in this, I mean, it's quite interesting, the missionary view of the U.S., the missionaries in China, you know, promoted this view of the U.S. that was accepted among Chinese intellectuals as a kind of model of economic development, and to some extent even a political model.
They could follow. Did that mean the U.S. was seen as less exploitive somehow of the Chinese as well?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, that's exactly right. The U.S. was viewed, by and large, as the least dangerous of the foreign powers, and therefore, and even in some ways a model, and therefore a country that could be used diplomatically to pit against other powers, to try to restrain the British or later restrain the Japanese. And if I can just add, I mean, that kind of favorable view persists through much of the 19th century, almost to the end.
And today?
Let me just say, the immigration issue that Eric mentioned begins to tarnish the U.S. image, and then when the U.S. takes the Philippines,
the immigration issue, that is Chinese denied access to the United States.
Yes, that's right.
Exclusion.
That's right, because of persecution, exclusion, and that Eric sort of picks up where or leaves off where the issue begins to heat up, and it remains an issue right up through the turn of the century. In fact, there's a major boycott, kind of nationalist boycott, against U.S. goods early in the 20th century.
Eric, if I may, trying to sort of track these strands back from the period you're writing about up to our current conversation, I mean, Professor Hunt talks about the myth of humiliation. Now, there clearly was also humiliation, you write, of China during that time, but also it's sort of grown into this. What about on the American side? You write about how the certain ideas about the Chinese as nefarious grew up in this time. When they were up against the wall sometimes, they were scrabbling in tough trade. Some of those things, you know, watch out, all that came into American culture. Do you see those as still active today in our interaction sometimes? I mean, China says, look, we're just rising up to be what we are. And yet there's a lot of American skepticism.
But back then, they weren't so concerned about China rising up and being a threat economically to the United States.
But there were cultural sort of stereotypes that were shared back to America then that you report in your book.
Right. I talk a lot about that and how the limited perspective that the Americans had by virtue of being largely corralled in Canton and being next to a certain class of Chinese trader and individuals perhaps jaundiced their view. And they had a very negative, by and large, a pretty negative view of Chinese traders and China itself. They were seeing it, in fact, as a declining empire, not this great empire of old. But as for whether or not we perceive that today and we have negative views towards China and the Chinese, the answer has to be yes and no. I mean, there are many people who understand China and think it's a great country. And the people that they, the connections that have been made, both are so much deeper now than they were in the past. And a lot of them are so positive. But still, mm-hmm. there are major things that fundamentally divide the two countries. So I think with almost every other country that we interact with, there are people that view the other side favorably and not.
Michael Hunt, we've just got 30 seconds. If there's one historical leftover Americans could get beyond, what would it be? And what about for the Chinese, that we could escape from this old history?
From the U.S. side, probably the notion that China is going to become like us. I mean, that's been one of the recurrent preoccupations, especially as you get, you know, move mm-hmm. farther into the 19th century and into the 20th, that, you know, with U.S. protection, U.S. guidance, U.S.
would be like, and from the Chinese side, our time is short.
For the Chinese side, I think it's suspicion of the U.S. That it becomes the views shift. The U.S. becomes a much more threatening power. I think in general intellectuals, Chinese government views through the 20th century.
We'll look to get beyond those. Michael Hunt in Chapel Hill, thank you for joining us. And Eric J. Dolan, author of When America First Met China. Thank you so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.